Welcome to Neonatology Now, the official podcast of the European School of Neonatology. Here at Neonatology Now, we are shining a light on the real-world experiences of world-renowned experts in perinatal medicine. Together, we will learn from top medical doctors, researchers, and opinion leaders to better understand how we can improve professional neonatal care in Europe and beyond. It's not just about the science. It's about the stories and experiences shaping this critical field of medicine. And now, without further ado, let me introduce you to your host, a seasoned neonatologist and our guide through these fascinating conversations, Professor Mario Rüdiger. Mario, take it away.
Welcome to a new episode of Neonatology Now, the podcast of the European School of Neonatology. Today's topic, variations in outcome of 22 and 23 beakers. I'm Professor Rüdiger and my guest for today is Dr. Prakash Shah from Mount Sinai Hospital, Toronto. So today it's my pleasure to welcome Dr. Prakash Shah as a guest. Prakash, welcome to Neonatology Now.
Thank you very much. Thank you for having me. It's an honor.
Yes, so we will have about 45 minutes to talk about your recent publication and the iNeo initiative. But however, before we get into details, I would like to introduce my guest as usually. And Prakash, you graduated at the Municipal Medical College in Ahmedabad in India, and you also worked in India. And then you went to the UK to work as a house officer and register for about 4 years. And thereafter, you went to Canada to do a fellowship in neonatal perinatal medicine at the University of Toronto. And finally, you became a consultant neonatologist at the Mount Sinai Hospital in Toronto. And currently, you are a pediatrician in chief at Mount Sinai Hospital and professor of pediatrics and health policy, management and evaluation at the University of Toronto. And your research is on quality improvement, and you're the leading force in international neonatal quality improvement initiatives, and you co-led the International Network for Evaluation of Outcomes, the iNeo initiative, which collaborates across global neonatal consortia to benchmark and elevate clinical care. So that's a very short summary of your work. Anything I missed which is of importance for you?
Yeah, no, thank you very much. Thank you for that kind introduction. No, I also led the Canadian Neonatal Network from 2012 to 2024. And now I'm the scientific chair for the network and finished my 2 terms as the director of the Canadian Neonatal Network.
Okay. Just to learn my guests better to know, I always ask for a special anecdote in your professional career. And so you worked in different places. Do you have an anecdote you want to share with our listeners?
Oh, thank you. Well, I mean, yeah, I have learned a lot of anecdotes from my superiors and stuff. And a couple of them, I've also used it in my editorials or asked to write commentary. The first one is the only constant is change in neonatology. And did an editorial on New England on that to explain that what we are facing in the terms of neonatology. Second one is to build a network and support network was if you are counted, then you will be accounted. But if you don't count them, you won't be accounted. And that's where comes the networking as well as collecting data and understanding what is happening. And the third one was Professor Olsen, one of my senior mentor from Sweden and when I was at Toronto. And he used to tell me that if you torture data enough, the data will confess. And that has been
That's a very good quote, yes. But I think it's very important to realize if you really look at the data and you benchmark yourself, it could be a pain for yourself because you see your data and you compare it and then you have to realize so others maybe are better.
Yeah. Yeah, well, and that's what the springboard that founded the iNeo, because what we learned in 2007, that the outcomes between 2007 and 10 or 2010 and 12, the outcomes didn't much change in Canada and starting to, but did not do much impact kind of thing. And then we started seeing reports from Japan and Australia and others showing the improved survival and improved survival with better outcome, then we just question ourselves that are we the only way? If we look in, keep on looking at ourselves, we are never going to improve. We need to look outside. And that's where the INEO was born, when I was fortunate to connect with the, at that time, 7 networks and get them to say that, can we get together and learn from each other? At that time, all 7 felt that they are the best, to be truthful, until the data came in and the data showed who and what kind of thing. So that opened eyes for everybody. And then that has been the success that is going on from 2012 onwards.
Yeah. So today we will be discussing your latest publication in JAMA Pediatrics, which is entitled Outcomes of Preterm Infants Born at 22 to 23 Weeks of Gestation in 11 International Networks. And actually, this landmark study evaluated survival, major morbidities, and international practice variations for over, I think, 5,000 infants cared for in 11 networks across 12 countries. And this study provides us critical insight into outcomes at the boundary of viability and where global practice converge or diverge. And could you tell our listeners a bit more about the background of that study and the INEO Collaborative?
Yeah, sure. No, thank you. So the INEO Collaborative started in around 2012 when we had a Japanese fellow, Tetsuya Isayama, who is the lead author on this paper, or the first author on this paper, came to do fellowship in Canada from Japan. And when we, after 3 months of his fellowship, he and I were on night one day, and I asked him what differences he is finding, because I know the Japan had better outcome. And I asked him, what are the differences he's finding? And he said, well, this is the difference. This is how we do. This is the difference, blah, blah, blah. And I said, well, is it possible for you to bring the Canadian data so we can look into detail about those clinical practices? And that's where he was able to convince the leaders at the Japanese network and get the data to Canada. And then we compared. And the initial comparison was between just Canada and Japan. And in that, we found that the care and outcomes were better for less than 26 weeks in Japan, significantly. But when it came to 27, 28, 29 weeks, the care and outcomes in Canada was better. And that was a shock to him, and that was a surprise to us as well. And that basically sparked the interest. And of course, half of the Japanese neonatologists were questioning, and 1/4 of them even came to Canada to see what the hell are you doing? And same happened to us. We went there to see what are you doing that is better and stuff. But at that time, we basically put out a call in the national network. So initially, we targeted only networks which has a national or near national coverage, and say that, are we able to get together one day in for a couple of days in Toronto, which we will get together and talk about, and how can we make this happen? And of course, there are differences in data collection between the system, between the networks, differences in some of the outcomes even being assessed. But we were able to narrow down and harmonize the definition and practices and outcomes between the 7 networks and got together. And then the first paper that came out was in Journal of Pediatrics, comparing the outcomes similarly for 24 to 32 weeks babies, where we found significant differences. And I can tell you that there wasn't a country which was good for all outcomes. Every country was good for one outcomes or one practices compared to the other.
Okay.
So that was an eye-opener for all of us. And all of us learned that, we are doing good in this one, but we're not doing this well. What do we do? And that's where we basically facilitated some teams to go across, go to the various units in the respective countries, sit there, look, listen, learn, and see what you can take it back. Not everything that other people are doing that you can take and apply to your setting. There was very much reservation between 2016 to 2022 when it came to the management of 22 and 23, or comparing outcomes of 22 and 23 weeks. Because people felt that, well, it is all practice dependent, unit dependent, some units does this, some units not, and stuff like that. But we reached in neonatology at a stage in 23 that many people were working on 22 and 23 weeks gestation babies across every network. And then we push the agenda and say that, look, we know we will have problem. We will not have a 100% perfect comparison because we are not going at 22 weeks mother who is in labor. We are talking about 22 weeks baby who is in NICU. So it has passed certain hurdles to reach that stage. Mm-hmm. But still, we will have useful and important information to learn for each other as well as for everybody in the world. And that's mm-hmm. where this process started. And then we had approval from all the directors that we want to. By that time, we grew to 11 networks and 12 countries. So all of them were happy to join and work on it and review the results. The first aspect was to convince them, okay, well, let's review the results and see. Are you willing, are you okay and willing to put this out in the world? Because there are differences, as you can see from the paper.
Yeah, I was surprised to see that you did not only compare outcome, but also practice. So how can I, could you explain our listeners, what did you do to compare practice?
So in majority of these networks, when they collect the data, they had data on common practices that everybody feels or thinks that are associated with neonatal outcomes. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And the first and foremost being antenatal CRY. And there was a lot of discussion and concern regarding the antenatal steroid that, okay, mm-hmm. well, only the baby who we are going to resuscitate will be giving. Other babies, people are not giving. People don't know whether it is efficacious because all the randomized trials are beyond 24 weeks gestation. So the outcomes associated with antenatal steroid administration in 22, 23 weeks was significantly unknown. And this was also fueled by Japanese colleagues, where the antenatal steroid rate was, even for 24 to 32 weeks, was significantly lower. Yet, their outcomes were significantly better. Their rate is 60%. Any antenatal steroid between 24 and 32 is 50 to 60. They're trying to improve it. Mm-hmm. But those are the things that some of the antenatal characteristics that we studied. So first was antenatal steroid. Second is the cesarean section. Mm-hmm. Now, it's an intention. Nobody is going to do cesarean section if there is going to be a non-resuscitation. So it is associated with what is the intention, what is the plan, and what is the process that people want to put in when the babies are born. But those were, and the third one was, where is the baby born? Is it in near the tertiary unit or is it babies born outside of the tertiary unit? Where the facility skills of individual to resuscitate such tiny neonates may not be as optimal as one would like to be in tertiary care center. And that reflects as to your psychology, mm-hmm. whether the unit or the network is willing to resuscitate this infants or not, or whether mm-hmm. parents are also in agreement to resuscitate this such mm-hmm. infants mm-hmm. as well. So that's why we compared those practices. And you can see, it's like at 22 week, the variation was huge. In some networks, it was 80% antenatal steroid and some was reaching 0%.
So, you also showed striking variation in survival or even in morbidity among the 22, 23 weekers across networks. To what extent do you think these differences stem from clinical decision-making philosophy, that means where active resuscitation is offered, versus structural factors like resource availability or NICU capacity?
Yeah, I think it's everything together. I don't think it is only the intention, it is also the system level factors, what is the culture in your unit? What are the practices that are being practiced? And what is the approach towards either family or the baby who is born at 22, 23 weeks? General approach in the unit, and that dictates as to what happens, what would be the outcome. And I think it is a combination of everything. And that is the main thing that we wanted to highlight, that this is not a competition or this is not an expectation or this is not, we are not putting it out as a goal. This is the survival you should target. It's just putting it out that this variations that we are observing are multitude of factors. And it is not a single factor that oh, I can resuscitate or I can manage these babies in the first 48 hours, 72 hours or not kind of thing. So care practices, attitudes, culture, all those things come into play in addition to the physical or the capacity to provide the resuscitation. What you may have noticed, and we have published it in the pediatrics as well, when unit starts to care for babies at a lower gestational age, the 1 week above, the care improves significantly. And so it is not that, okay, no, we are not doing 22, 23 week, but our 24 weekers are same as other people. No, it takes time. And particularly in my unit, I have observed that now 23 week baby comes, nobody even kind of feel, oh, this is not a small baby. Like that smallness is gone. From thinking.
I have experienced these 30 years ago when we started to have 27, 26 speakers. Everybody was thinking, oh, that's crazy. But nowadays, it's not a problem. And But when you already said that you also went to Japan and to look at the NICU and see the differences. Do you think there are any differences which are not found in the recorded data? Because sometimes you see at the guideline and then you think, oh, the guideline is very similar to my approach. But then you go to a different place and you think, oh, the guideline is same, but it's different anyway.
Yeah, I would not say that probably people, I mean, every unit works differently. Every unit works according to protocol. But we found some challenging practices that was so it will take a long time before even I can convince my people over here or the unit in Germany that I can convince or something like that. Because I have been, we came to Germany as well with Dr. Krips units to learn about the Buena Vista valve and how to provide the CPAP. And like she was even saying that even 22 weekers, she just continues to gently stimulate them from the back and not put on ventilator. And so trying to learn that, okay, what is happening? But certain practices, and which is probably like not difficult to sell. But there are practices when we went to Japan and we saw kind of thing will have a very big, big challenges, such as one of them is like a cord milking. They are very, very, very fond of, and I would say a lot of the units in Japan will do cord milking and not the deferred cord clamping. The second one was giving glycerin enema Q6 for the first 3-4 days in this 22 weeker.
Giving what? Say again, sorry.
Enema, glycerin enema.
Ah, okay.
To remove the meconium, to get it out so that they can continue to feed from the top.
Okay.
The milk kind of thing. Now, it has not shown in the randomized control trial, not shown in systematic review. Will be very hard to convince any Canadian nurses to do it Q6 in such a tiny, fragile babies and stuff. They do 2 to 3 times echo and manage their fluid accordingly, which is not, we don't do it and not neither probably practical to be done in our setting as well. So there are differences that I have observed. I mean, I have gone to Iowa and seen how they practice as well for the management of this 22, 23 weeker and a completely different approach. So I've learned that I don't think it is one approach versus another approach that is going to make you better in getting outcomes. I think it's you need to find your own.
Okay.
Every unit will have to find their own.
Yeah. But you referred to the difference in practice, antenatal practice. In your opinion, is there any perinatal practice that has a very specific benefit? Or which is very pivotal for the outcome?
Yeah. So in my experience and as well as from the Canadian Neonatal Network data that we have shown is that a few things that helps. One is the delivery of these babies in a tertiary neonatal care unit and not the secondary level unit. So as much as possible to transfer this mother who is in labor or who is impending to be labor to the tertiary care unit rather than keeping them in the level 2 units. The second one is antenatal steroid. I know we have some challenges in terms of the giving steroid to possibly some of the women which may not deliver preterm and deliver at full term and can have consequences. But this is the one that has shown significantly to reduce the mortality at least. The third one is the deferred cord clamping. Mm-hmm. I think the benefits are well known and well established in most of the settings. Mode of birth is not yet settled, that whether you deliver them cesarean section versus vaginal. I think it will be a tough failed randomized control trial attempts and tough to generate evidence on that aspect. Fourth one we try to support in and push in our units is achieving normothermia at admission. And I think that has also significantly reduced mortality in the majority of the studies that we see. And finally, as much as possible, mother's own milk.
Actually, that's rather easy to achieve, one should say. It's not fancy drugs or fancy interventions, but it's very difficult in daily life to do it, to achieve it, yes.
Yeah. Okay. When MaxSelf has been shown to be neuroprotective, and we will promote, and we do get in our network ups to 80% of uptake, and antenatal MaxSelf for intrapartum magnesium sulfate. And when we looked at the four interventions together, like steroid, MaxSelf, delayed cord clamping, and normothermia, we found that if a baby gets 2 out of 4, has a similar outcome as 3 out of 4 or 4 out of 4.
Okay. Yeah.
So if you miss antenatal steroid or MaxSelf, then deferred cord clamping and normothermia are
still have two shots.
Good one. That can be in your control.
Okay. Although survival varied greatly, as you already said, from single digit to over 60%, the rates of severe brain injury, survival without such injury also differed. And how should these differences inform what clinicians share with families during counseling? Because it's not just about survival, but it's also about quality of survival.
Absolutely. And I think that's a big discussion that one need to have with the prospective parents about not only the survival as well as the intact survival or survival without neurodevelopmental disability or neurological injury, even in the newborn period. And I would not say anybody to take this number and go and counsel their family as an average number or anything. I would suggest and highly recommend everybody to look at their own data. Compile the number, get your numbers, and counsel in regards to what you are able to achieve. And you are. This is all network level comparison. So there may be few high performing units, and there would be few low performing units. So it can give you an average effect. However, in order for you to counsel your family in front of you, you need to have your local data and a counsel with the local data. There is a high risk of mortality, and there is a high risk of complications. Like if you look at the 22-week, half of them needed treatment for ROP amongst the survivor. Now, I don't think we counsel them adequately enough. And these are always the later on finding, now my baby has to have eye exam, and now my baby have a treatment in the eye, et cetera, et cetera. So I think fully comprehensive picture painting is what is needed, and a guided counseling with the parents as well as working with them to come to a consensus as to what they would like and what is appropriate for them at this stage in their life for their family. Such baby affects everybody, parents, family, other children, everyone.
That's a good point. And given the high rates of ROP, NEC, or BPD, how can the neonatal networks best balance striving for survival at these gestations with mitigating the burden of morbidities?
Yeah, I think as against one of the quotation, I mean, only constant in the neonatology is change. We have seen the change. I mean, we were not talking about 22-weeker 5 years ago, 7 years ago. now we are talking, and I have heard some of the units from some of the units that they have 21-week survivors that are going home. So this debate is not going to stop. We are going to continue to pursue. People will, but I think it needs to come with an understanding as to what it brings. And it behooves on all of us to continue to monitor these infants and follow these infants to understand what outcomes that they evolve into so that we can counsel the families on a daily basis properly. There are complications. There are challenges. These are not easy days. In first 2 weeks is very tough on these babies, families, and everybody, even caretakers. And you need to constantly debrief in your unit as to who, what is happening, why are we doing, what discussion. Involve everybody in the discussion with the parents so they understand, rather than get an isolated messages about care of these babies. But overall, I think you need to look at your own data, look at your own practices, and then challenge yourself.
Yeah, it's sometimes difficult because during the very first few days, you never know what happens on the longer term, and then you cannot decide anymore what to do. And that's always very difficult, I feel, to explain to parents that we don't know. We can try our best, but we don't know what happens at the end. And
absolutely.
So you were talking about the large international network you are collaborating with. And this finding of INEO, do you think this finding will promote the reduction of variation, or are we going, or does it help to harmonize guidelines or standardize care bundles?
Yeah, I think that's a very important question, because the one thing is just to put out data, and second thing is to do something, or information, and second thing is to create community, collaborate, work together to harmonize, or to understand that, okay, these are the things we all agree on. These are the things that are, we still need, don't know, and we need to study, either in a randomized trial or a comparative effectiveness or between the comparison. And these are the things that make sense, but we have no evidence. And we leave it to the unit to decide what works for them, kind of thing. And to get to the first part, that these are the things that we all agree on, we should get together. And I think one of the initiatives that has been developed by Tiny Baby Collaborative by Matt Risavi, which is striving to do this. And we all are part of it, and we all are trying to understand as to what and where, which practices are associated with the best outcome. It is very hard to do randomized control trial in this population. It may look 5,000, a big number kind of thing, but it took us several years and several networks to get to this number of babies. So to do a proper trial specifically limited to this population would be very challenging. I won't say impossible, but very challenging. So we definitely need to get together and develop some harmonized guidelines. So what we have done in the next phase of this, or during this phase, was to survey all these units about their practices as to what are you doing. And then once in 2 years' time, we will have the neonatal data on from those units. We'll link those survey practices with the outcomes to understand that, are there any practices that are associated with. We cannot say this is the cause and effect, but at least we can comment on association that certain practices are associated with the outcomes that we are all striving to reach for. We did that in 2015, and then I learned a lot about the variation at a physical level, the unit level, healthcare professional level, who is taking care of these babies in the first 7 days. One is to one, 1:2, 1:3. All these have important indication or indicators of outcome, which are the non-written policies, or non-verbal, verbalized policy.
Good point,
Like a neonatologist, are in-house or not? And are they attending these births or not? Or they're attending after first 15, 20 minutes are gone? Or what is the process that happens in each of the unit, kind of thing? So we have repeated that survey in 2023 along with this comparison. And we will be coming out with a few kind of papers to show that these are the variations across different countries, such as the cord milking processes, what oxygen you use at the time of resuscitation, what you start with, where you go, what pressure you start with, how much maximum you go before you give surfactant. If baby has a gram-positive infection, how long you treat, gram-negative, because we have variations. Trying to learn from that variations to see that, okay, what is associated, and then come out with the base practices that these are the units with the better outcome, these are their practices, and give a forum for those units and networks to give a platform to present themselves and talk to others. In Canada, what we do is we get 32 units get together every year, physically sit together, and everybody tells what they have been doing last year, what initiative they have initiated that has led to any changes, not changes in processes, outcomes. And then other people learn from each other, connect to each other, take their checklist, take their guideline, take their protocol, modify, implement, or go to place and sit there and watch how it is being done. That's the goal. That's my goal for not just putting out numbers and outcomes, but for people to talk to each other and learn from each other.
Yeah, that's a very good point. And I think sometimes we can learn from oncology because they have standardized protocols and it's not always a randomized controlled trial. But if you adhere to the standardized protocol, then you get good data and then you can change the protocol afterwards.
Yeah, absolutely. And we took that comparative effectiveness approach in our network very hard. We finished one big 3,500 babies, 1,700 babies study on whether to use CPAP or NIPPV post-extubation. Because all the studies that have compared the both randomized trials have different pressures. The CPAP is being tried at 7, 8 and give up, whereas NIPPV is 16 and 18 on 8 and so. And NIPPV will come out to be superior because you are using higher distending pressure.
That's a good point.
And we basically standardize in every unit. We gave them the option that what do you want to standardize to, CPAP or NIPPV? And we had half of the unit did CPAP, half did NIPPV. We compared and we found that, yes, reintubation would be higher particularly babies who were randomized, who were managed on CPAP. However, if you look at the 7 days, the CPAP arm did exactly was non-inferior to NIPPV.
Okay.
So why did you use proper equivalent pressure?
Pressure. That's a good point.
And so we have started, we have now five such comparative effectiveness research as oncology going on in the Canadian neonatal network. Dopamine versus norepinephrine. Do you extubate to two centimeter higher post-extubation or same mean airway pressure as the baby was on invasive ventilation? These are the practices that people are married to and don't want to give up.
That's a good point. Because if you think you are doing a good job, then you should not change your practice. But if you realize the other centers are better than you, then you should start to think about changing your practice.
Changing the practices.
So I was very much surprised about the Japanese data that they use cord milking very often, because the guidelines actually prohibit cord milking below 28 weeks of gestation. And so nobody would do a study anymore on this one. So it's very difficult to convince people.
No, they are doing it and they are not changing it. They even have videos to circulate between the units how to do it.
That's a very good approach. I'm very fond of taking videos for resuscitation or so, and then to look at what people are doing, because if people are talking about it, it's different than what you are seeing, what they are doing or doing, they think they are doing.
Absolutely.
So Prakash, at the end, just let's talk about the future. And what other plans does the iNeo initiative have? You already mentioned a few plans, but I guess you have much more.
No, absolutely. So it has been fortunate. And when I'm talking here about this paper on behalf of all those networks and the leaders and the people who have contributed data, so I'm so grateful for them to send this data. We are growing. We have Taiwan joining soon, within probably a week or so. Norway joining soon. So we have the national networks coming and be wanting to be part. Our goal in the next phase of INEO is to compare the neurodevelopmental outcome. We have compared the neonatal outcomes, compared the survival, neonatal outcomes, but now we are going to look at the 2 to 3 years. There are a lot more challenges over there because of the differences in who and how is being assessed, what measures people are doing. So I have a group of experts in neurodevelopmental outcome kind of thing have created the harmonized way of assessing, whether it's a Kyoto assessment or whether it's a Bayley assessment or a Griffith assessment, as to how we can put it together that could look similar. It cannot be exactly same, but look similar, but at least give us an idea as to what is the outcome. Because more and more we do neonatology, people will keep on asking, yeah, but what are they doing at 2 years, 3 years, or even beyond? So we took it as a first step that we will go to the 2 to 3 years outcome for the neurodevelopmental, as well as the growth and respiratory outcome. So I have a few networks who are actually collecting the data, like a Swedish network, the Australia, New Zealand, Canadians, the UK, Japanese, and just finishing up the contract so that we can get the data. Mm-hmm. And then we will start looking at it, because it is possible that neurodevelopmental outcomes may look similar depending upon what gestational age you resuscitate and you provide care.
So do you also look at the parents' impact? So because there is a large variation how parents are empowered, involved, and so on. And I think it's a major impact on the long-term outcome.
Yeah. So we don't have a robust data that is being collected by most of the networks. We are starting in Canada to collect some of the information associated with the baby, with the parental outcome or parent-reported or parent-important outcomes. To get more information even during the follow-up as well as during the NICU. We are a strong believer of family-integrated care. So I think it's no surprise or nothing new that everybody is trying and helping the families. But there is we're trying to work with our network to see if we can come up with the standard parameters that is important to parents and that we should continue to collect across the network. What happens in this INEO is that there are variables that may be suggested by a certain group of people, but not everybody is collecting. So we put it out and say that, are you guys interested going forward to collect this data? These are the objectives, and this is what is coming from this group with this kind of idea that they want to collect this information for. And then we continue to see who will collect and who will be able to transform that data so that we can compare.
That's interesting. So Prakash, I could talk to you for more than 2 hours, but we have to come to an end of our podcast. And I always ask a personal question at the end of the podcast. So based on your personal experience, what do you recommend students who are at the beginning of their career?
No, that's very important. And training is one of the aim for INEO as well. And we basically are supporting trainees from each network. So this data is available to anybody from any network. They just have to come up with one question, one small protocol. We get approval and we process the data and give them the results so that they can write the paper and present and stuff. I think training is very important. My advice to the trainees starting the career would be to be persistent and to choose a focus if they can. If not, take to the people who are successful within your organization where you are being trained and learn from them as to what happened, what is their story, how did they start. I mean, when I came to Canada, I had one abstract in UK and two papers in India under my belt that I came. But I was fortunate that I had mentors who had done this before, to sit with them, talk to them, learn from them, throw questions. I when a trainee comes to me, I first say that, okay, come up with 3-4 questions that interest you. So do what interests you. And when they come up, we go back and forth. The first meeting, I tell them that don't be disappointed that we won't be going ahead with any of your questions in first three meetings you come up with. But keep on coming. Keep coming back, because there is a lot more for us to learn from the babies and the families. So be persistent, identify a good mentor, focus on your career path as to what you want to achieve, and it will happen. And finally, some of the trainees get disappointed when the papers are rejected. And I give them example. I had one that was rejected 8 times and published okay. 9th time. So if you've done a good work, somebody will publish.
Excellent. That's a very good final word. Rakesh, thank you very much for the interesting talk.
Thank you very much. Thank you for having me, and thank you very much.
That was it again. Neonatology Now, the podcast of the European School of Neonatology. Now you're really on the mic, and my guest for today was Prakash Shah. If you do have any questions or comments, do not hesitate to contact us. Thank you for listening.